He was very agitated by the demonstrations and remained concerned about the embassy. He spoke to reporters later that evening and said the United States didn't want war with Iran. Tehran pushed back, of course, denying any role in the attacks or the protests that followed, calling the U.S. actions crimes, and alleging that America was responsible for all the turmoil in the region. Not knowing how the situation would unfold in the coming days, I wanted more forces on the ground to support the embassy, help defend bases where U.S. personnel were located, evacuate American citizens if it came to that, and provide us some additional offensive capability if things continued to escalate. I discussed this with General Milley around 9:30 a.m. The nearest large contingent of ground forces was an Amphibious Ready Group Marine Expeditionary Unit, ARGMEU, which totals more than 3,500 service members and is made up of a reinforced Marine Infantry Battalion and a naval task force that delivers and supports them. However, the flotilla was in the Western Mediterranean. It would take up to 10 days to steam close enough to assist. I asked Milley to look at other options, to include deploying the Ready Brigade from the 82nd Airborne Division. They had an 18-hour wheels-up mission for the first elements of their more than 3,000 paratroopers to deploy from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. The 82nd didn't bring the full punch that an ARGMEU could, with the latter's combat vehicles and attack aircraft, but the Ready Brigade could get more troops on the ground quickly. Therefore, in addition to ordering the Marines in the Mediterranean to quickly head east, I directed the 82nd to launch as well. I wasn't waiting for directions from the White House. On January 1, 2020, the first 750 paratroopers began deploying to Kuwait. In the meantime, we also launched a squadron of special operators to Iraq in the event we needed their extraordinary capabilities. With the forces we had on the ground in Baghdad, not to mention those flowing in, there was little concern among commanders about the militias seizing the embassy. We also discussed the whereabouts of Soleimani. According to the IC, he was still in Iran, but planning to fly to Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria to coordinate and direct a larger series of attacks against U.S. personnel and facilities. Milley and I discussed the security at our embassies in Beirut, Bahrain, and Kuwait City, the latter two because of the number of U.S. troops they were hosting and the problems they had in the past with their own Tehran-sponsored Shia militants. I was concerned about them, so I called Pompeo to discuss this matter with him. State would later ask for reinforcements for our embassy in Lebanon, given the threat streams they were seeing. Pompeo and I talked about this a couple of times before I deployed a platoon of paratroopers from my old unit in Vicenza, Italy, into Beirut and held additional soldiers nearby. A spokesperson for KH reportedly said the Baghdad protests were only a first step and called upon the United States to close its embassy and withdraw all its forces from Iraq. If only they knew how much President Trump had wanted to do both. Ironically, their actions were making such a move less likely. For now, the rhetoric coming out of Iran and Iraq, coupled with the intelligence on Soleimani we were receiving, suggested some difficult days ahead. As such, I wanted Mackenzie to get all our ships in Bahrain, where the 5th Fleet is headquartered, out to sea. Iranian missiles would find U.S. vessels congregated in port to be easier targets. We had discussed this previously and had a good understanding of where our ships would go, far enough to be safe, but close enough to go on the offense. I did another quick update call with Pence, Pompeo, O'Brien, and Milley a little after 10 a.m. Pompeo informed us that Trump ordered the chargé d'affaires in Baghdad to repel all attacks and that under no circumstances was the embassy to surrender, reflecting his deep angst over what was happening on the ground. The president's concern about the embassy and the militants overrunning it, as had happened in Benghazi, was consuming him, which in turn made him angrier and angrier about the protests. I reassured everyone that we had sufficient force to beat back any assault, with the total number of U.S. military personnel at the embassy by the end of the day numbering in the hundreds, and a variety of strike platforms available in the airspace above the compound to provide support. At 2 p.m., we held another update call. For the DOD, the bottom line was that we were steadily building combat power in Baghdad specifically and Iraq generally. The new reporting about Soleimani planning retaliatory attacks prompted me to send the entire division-ready brigade from Fort Bragg. You can never have too much infantry in these situations. Pompeo reported that things had stabilized in Baghdad. It was nighttime in Iraq by this point, and the local Iraqi forces were finally back in place, providing perimeter security around our embassy. None of us had much confidence, however, that these troops would hold the line if the militias returned. Meanwhile, Pompeo was looking to relocate some of his people to our consulate in Erbil, in the northern part of Iraq controlled by the Kurds, where they would be safer. I offered to assist in their movement. With regard to Soleimani, the most recent reporting had put him in Damascus with plans to travel to Beirut next, and then Baghdad. The intelligence said he was orchestrating multiple attacks against Americans in several locations with heavy consequences for the United States. His aim was to get the United States to leave Iraq much like we had departed Lebanon decades earlier after the Beirut barracks bombing. However, from our perspective, the consequences his plans might actually provoke would likely result in the United States attacking Iran, not leaving Iraq. Given the president's inclinations, this could mean a large follow-on response and a good chance that war between the United States and Iran would commence. We held another internal DOD update on Wednesday, January 1st. The situation remained stable at Embassy Baghdad overnight, and by now we had well reinforced the compound. Units from the States continued to flow into theater. Naval forces moved into more protected positions in the Persian Gulf, Gulf of Oman, and the Arabian Sea, and we now had heavy army forces, tanks and fighting vehicles, loading up in Kuwait to move north toward the Iraqi capital. On the other hand, the Iraqis were not supporting in-country movement by coalition forces. They were... Text redacted. Overall, McKenzie said he was in good shape for the next 24 to 36 hours, and our partners in the region were lashed up well with his command at the military level. I began Thursday, January 2nd, with an early update call to the president. Millie joined me as we ran through the latest intelligence, the security we had at the embassy, our broader force protection measures, and the additional forces we had moving into Iraq to bolster our defenses and capabilities. Trump was in a good place, but still anxious about the embassy and the threats we were all hearing coming out of the region. He wanted an update on our retaliatory options, with a focus on Soleimani. Later in the morning, General Milley and I met with the media to update them. One of the issues raised was whether I expected KH to take more actions that were provocative. Of course, by this time, we knew that Soleimani was orchestrating an attack against Americans, and we were preparing our own actions to go after him. As such, I responded by recounting the increasing number of attacks against the United States and our coalition partners in the previous months and said, "So do I think they may do something? Yes, and they will likely regret it." I added later in the media gaggle, "If we get word of attacks or some type of indication, we will take preemptive action as well to protect American forces, to protect American lives. So the game has changed, and we're prepared to do what is necessary to defend our personnel and our interests and our partners in the region, to include those sponsoring and directing them in Iran." This was my last warning to Soleimani and Tehran. At 1 p.m., we held a conference call with the president, Pence, Pompeo, Haspel, O'Brien, Milley, and maybe Mulvaney. Some White House staff were on the call as well. Milley and I updated everyone on our force posture, which was in very good shape and growing. The conversation quickly pivoted to Soleimani and his plans. According to the latest intelligence, Soleimani was indeed in Damascus, having gone to Beirut first, contrary to earlier reports, and expected to depart for Baghdad in a few hours. He was reportedly pushing hard for attacks against the U.S. Embassy and other sites in and outside of Iraq where Americans were located. Soleimani would likely need to get the final okay from the Ayatollah Khamenei before launching the campaign, the intelligence official briefed. They had every reason to believe Khamenei would approve the plan since Soleimani was recommending it. Moreover, the plan was likely only days away from initiation, based on the IC's best estimates. Regardless, the IC, in fact all of us, had little confidence that Tehran could restrain the militia groups for much longer than that anyway. A lot of questions, answers, and comments went back and forth on the line. Most folks were generally in the same places they were the week prior. O'Brien was pushing hard for a full panoply of strikes. Pence and Pompeo were in the same camp, also advocating for a very tough response, but neither was strident about the matter and both were open to less dramatic action. Milley and I were supportive but somewhat reluctant, concerned about how this would play out two or three steps beyond the next one. If we killed Soleimani, the United States could well end up in a major Middle East war. The Iranians were a proud people with a track record of responding proportionately in some way, shape, or form to any assault on their country or their citizens. The maximum pressure campaign that was devastating their nation, coupled with the importance of maintaining their credibility with their proxies throughout the Middle East, would likely put additional pressure on the regime to retaliate. The question was, what would their response be if we killed a senior Iranian officer? In our view, Soleimani was a military officer on an active battlefield he created, coordinating the next round of attacks designed to kill more of his enemy, Americans. It was an occupational risk he was taking if he exposed himself, which he had done with increasing boldness in recent years. He was very capable, and indeed unique in many ways, but he was also the head of a foreign terrorist organization. He arrived at this moment in time with the blood of thousands of U.S. service members on his hands. At what point was the U.S. government going to say enough when it came to killing and maiming Americans? What were the moral and ethical considerations of doing nothing versus doing something? These were just a few of the key questions we had to answer. Few things are certain in life, and when it comes to matters of war such as we were discussing that Thursday afternoon, the grays became grayer, the risks seem riskier, and the uncertainties become more uncertain. It was good that we were kicking these issues around and doing so as a team. However, we also needed to find an anchor upon which to make a final decision. In my mind, it often came down to core values, basic principles, established policy, and the goal you want to achieve. In this case, at this point, the foundation began with the assessment of the IC, those who knew Iran and the Iranians best, followed by our best collective judgment. For me, this had to be consistent with the factors I mentioned and my 9 considerations when it came to making a final recommendation to the president regarding the use of military force. Of the 9 considerations that I carried around with me, the ones that jumped out immediately centered on the threat to the United States and its imminence, the appropriateness and proportionality of our proposed action, and the likely risks, costs, and consequences of conducting the operation and not doing so. The president asked CIA Director Gina Haspel her bottom line. Gina was a solid professional with extraordinary judgment and experience. She was also tough, but never in a rush to go into a fight unnecessarily. It was one reason the ties between her, Milley, and me were so tight. Her answer couldn't have been clearer or more concise, and she said it with studied confidence and authority. The risk of doing nothing is greater than the risk of doing something. That was it for me. General Frank McKenzie had come to the same conclusion earlier. We didn't want to go to war. A majority in that room did not. Nevertheless, Haspel's assessment affirmed my sense that a preemptive strike to prevent an imminent attack on Americans was the right thing to do. If presented with the same situation, but with some no-name Iranian general planning attacks instead, there would have been far less hesitation. Soleimani's stature clearly made a difference, but not so much that we could allow American diplomats and service members to be consciously left in harm's way. This was a core principle that we had to follow: the duty to protect our fellow citizens. Given the scale and scope of attacks the IC assessed Soleimani was planning, the number of Americans that could be killed and injured would be significant. Allowing that to happen would be immoral. If some of our people were murdered and we could have prevented it, how could I go to Dover Air Force Base weeks later to greet the flag-draped coffins that arrived home solemnly in the backs of the large Air Force jets, and then sit with the grieving spouses, children, and parents knowing that I could have saved their loved ones? President Trump quietly soaked it all in and then listened to anyone who wanted to make a comment. He was unusually focused. The air on the line was tense. It was as if we were collectively holding our breath while waiting for the president's decision. With the uniform support of his national security team, the commander-in-chief directed the strike on Soleimani for that evening in Baghdad, simply stating, "Okay, it's approved. Let's do it." Before wrapping up the call, we discussed a few other things. Vice President Pence asked about notifying the Department of Justice and the FBI. Hezbollah apparently had personnel in the United States, and we wanted to make sure law enforcement kept an eye on them in case Tehran ordered their activation. I noted that state and defense would be considering an ordered departure from countries such as Bahrain, which hosted large numbers of Americans. Pompeo and I would also be making calls to our allies and partners after the strike to inform them and seek their support. Finally, I asked O'Brien for a written White House legal opinion confirming we had the authority to strike Soleimani in Iraq, and raised the issue of informing Hill leaders. Chapter 6. America Strikes. The Airbus jet flew quietly through the night sky of the Middle East, far above the troubled land below it. Many on board were probably napping. Some were likely working, but only a few knew of the special person traveling with them that evening, and the plans he carried with him. His arrival and all that soon followed would mark another chapter in a difficult history. Soleimani was less than a couple of hours from arriving at Baghdad International Airport. We had hoped to target him in either Damascus or Beirut, but it was difficult to get a good fix on him in either place. Baghdad was different. He seemed to be very comfortable moving around the city, with a sense of unconcerned habit and predictability that we heard troubled his own people. The Israelis had been watching him for a long time, all around the region, and few things had become more routine than his arrival at the Baghdad airport. The landing of the commercial jet, the plane-side pickup by his local militia hosts, the long drive around the airport access road to the exit, plus the fact that few civilians were often in the area, presented an exceptional opportunity. Still, I was a little uncomfortable with conducting a military operation at the airport. I was concerned that doing so would result in our immediate eviction from Iraq by the government, an action that would affect our longer-term ability to prevent Tehran from fully dominating the country. It would also disrupt our ability to impede Iran's bad behavior in the region, especially the steady flow of arms and missiles west, across northern Iraq, into Syria, Lebanon, and beyond. Soleimani's plane landed around 12:30 a.m. Baghdad time on January 3rd and taxied into position as it normally did. Soon enough, the Airbus jet came to halt in a lit, open area short of the terminal. As the mobile stairs rolled up to the plane's door near the cockpit, a string of dark-colored cars pulled up in a line perpendicular to the staircase, not far from its base. A few minutes later, the door of the jetliner opened, and a worker seemed to scramble around to ensure it was properly in place. A flight attendant appeared to move around on the inside, just within the door, barely visible from the outside. After what seemed to be a few minutes, Soleimani emerged, offered a friendly gesture to someone, and slowly walked down the metal steps. A few people at the bottom of the stairs greeted him. They shook hands. Their deference to Soleimani was obvious nonetheless, even at night on the mostly empty black tarmac. This helped us identify both him and the sedan into which he would soon get. We had real-time overhead surveillance of everything that was happening from deep in the bowels of the Pentagon. It was a small, dimly lit room filled with computer terminals along the walls and video screens in the front. We had to go through a couple of different access points to get to it. There couldn't have been more than a dozen folks there, with mostly military personnel at their workstations. I had invited Mike Pompeo to join us at the Pentagon. Together, Pompeo, Millie, and I watched the operation unfold on a big screen, through the lenses of drones flying high above the airport. Others were at the White House. President Trump was still in Florida. It took only a few minutes for everyone on the ground in Baghdad to get into their cars and begin the long trek around the airport to the city not far beyond. It was a clear evening, and since it was now 10 or so minutes shy of 1 a.m. in Iraq, these were the only automobiles on the long stretch of road. We watched quietly as they followed the same route they had many times before. We knew the car that Soleimani was in, but were unsure who was with him. A couple of folks guessed quietly at who joined him in the back seat of the sedan, throwing around names of various militia group leaders. We were confident that it was a senior person from one of the Shia groups, but we didn't know which one, or if some Iraqi government official was with them. The two were becoming indistinguishable, as Iran seemed to slowly consume Iraq over time. As the cars moved into a long stretch of road designated as the strike area, I was surprised at the speed at which they were now traveling. The street lights that illuminated the road seemed to flash across the screen with increasing speed. Would this complicate our targeting? Would the missiles hit with the needed precision? Would the cars exit the airport before we had time to strike? When the small convoy proceeded past the halfway mark in the target area, I started to wonder if there was a complication on the operational end. Did we lose the track? Was there a malfunction? We knew soon enough. A few seconds later, a laconic voice came on the line to announce the release of the missiles. Now the wait. I could imagine the missiles dropping from the hard points on the drone wings and streaking downward toward the unwitting target far below, moving through the night sky with incredible speed and force. Meanwhile, the drone's cameras remained fixed and unblinking on the sedan that sped quickly down the empty road. The time from launch to hit seemed interminably long, and given the speed of the cars, one might have thought they would be well beyond the airport by the time the strike occurred. Soon enough, though, without any last-second visual cue of the missiles closing in on their target, a large explosion mushroomed in the middle of the screen, rapidly expanding in various shades of black, gray, and white, and moving down the highway all the while. It was surreal. There was dead silence in the room as we all stared at the screen, unsure of what to expect. Seconds went by. The video screen remained obscured by the explosion's effects. More time passed as we watched the black and white picture slowly clear, with the long, lonely curved highway running through the middle of it, and a large ink blot in the center emanating smoke and flames. We soon heard a dry, emotionless voice on the other end announce, "Targets destroyed." We all exhaled at once, it seemed, as the tension broke. The one thing that passed through my mind at that moment was the word, justice. Otherwise, I kept scanning the cloudy screen, scrutinizing it to make sure a vehicle hadn't somehow escaped the violence, or a person hadn't crawled away from the impact area. I watched for some time. Nothing. So ended the exceptional life and career of Qasem Soleimani, a general on the battlefield orchestrating his last campaign, the one that thankfully never came to fruition. His passing was far quicker and less painful than that suffered by the many U.S. soldiers and Marines he was responsible for killing over the years. From this moment going forward, no more Americans would die because of him, and certainly not in the next few days. I'm not sure who first informed President Trump of the mission's success, or whether he watched the strike on a live feed that was available to him. Pompeo, Milley, and I knew there was much more ahead of us now. There was no time for celebration. We quietly congratulated one another and those around us. I personally called and spoke with the mission commanders, thanking them and their forces for their professionalism and expertise. And then the Secretary of State, the Chairman, and I discussed some of the next steps we had to take as we prepared for Iran's next move. Pompeo quickly headed back to the State Department. I returned straight to my office. The pictures from the site that would emerge later showed a charred, mangled hunk of metal that was once a car, with burned pieces of it and another destroyed vehicle strewn 100 yards up and down the road in a variety of shapes and sizes. DNA samples taken from the scene, along with a dismembered left hand bearing a large red stone set in a silver ring that Soleimani always wore, confirmed his death. Nobody, nothing, could have survived the precision and violence of the strike. We would also learn that the attack killed other members of the PMF, including Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, a commander in the PMF who was also deputy chairman of the Popular Mobilization Committee that oversees it. In 2003, Muhandis had helped form KH, the Shia group responsible for the rocket attack that killed the American contractor days earlier. He had been involved in terrorist activities for decades, In fact, a court in Kuwait sentenced him to death 13 years earlier for his role in a series of bombings there in 1983. The United States had also designated Mohandas as a terrorist. Justice finally caught up with him, too. In the days following the strike, thousands of people filled the streets of Baghdad to protest the attack and the American presence in Iraq, demanding the eviction of the U.S. military from the country. While the crowd represented a broader swath of Iraqis living in the city than before, a large number were still pro-Iranian fighters, and most were Shias. On Friday, January 3rd, the American embassy in Iraq urged all U.S. citizens to leave the country. That same day, President Trump publicly said that he directed the strike because Soleimani was organizing imminent and sinister attacks on Americans, and that, "We took action last night to stop a war. We did not take action to start a war." One of the takeaways from the intelligence briefings and conversations we had had was that if Soleimani's plans were successful, the size and scope of them likely would have plunged us into war with Iran. In Tehran, the government declared 3 days of mourning, with thousands flooding the streets in cities across Iran to grieve Soleimani's death. The supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, paid a personal visit to Soleimani's family and promised a forceful revenge. Meanwhile, from Florida, Trump responded by vowing to strike 52 Iranian sites if an American citizen or U.S. interests were attacked. The number 52 referred to the number of Americans held by Iran in the 1979 hostage seizure. It was an idea put in his head by Robert O'Brien, and one that clearly had no operational logic behind it. Might we really be asked to find 52 separate sites to attack? These types of statements and ideas troubled me and others. To think that we would find more than 4 dozen targets simply because it was a clever rhetorical link to history plugged into a presidential statement was irresponsible. Moreover, announcing it without any consultation with military and civilian leaders responsible for effecting such a mission was disconcerting. If things went badly in the days and weeks ahead, the president was now out on a limb promising to strike 52 Iranian targets. If that occurred, there was little doubt that we would be at war with Iran. No country is going to absorb strikes against more than 4 dozen targets and simply take it. Worse yet, to make this happen, to deliver on the number 52, we would have to put military personnel in harm's way unnecessarily. We needed much more thoughtful deliberation and coordination on these things, and less shooting from the hip. On Saturday night, January 4th, after the IC had picked up indications that the Iranian military, especially its ballistic missile units, were going to a higher alert status, which we expected, Trump warned Iran of more U.S. strikes. He said via Twitter that some of the targets the U.S. military could attack were at a very high level and important to Iran and the Iranian culture, and those targets and Iran itself will be hit very fast and very hard. That same day, I did a check-in call with Eric Chuning, my chief of staff, Chairman Milley, and General McKenzie. The CENTCOM commander reported that all his forces were at an increased level of readiness. He was concerned principally about 3 potential Iranian responses: a ballistic missile attack, massive rocket attacks by the militia groups, and the targeting of one of our senior leaders in theater. He said the Iraqi military was still working with us, which was a good thing, and that he wasn't expecting Tehran to do anything until after the Iraqi parliament met and voted on whether to demand the U.S. military leave the country. Most of McKenzie's additional forces from the United States had arrived by then, and he had reinforced some of the embassies in the region. We reviewed our response options once again. Finally, McKenzie reported that he had spoken with nearly a dozen other countries who were with us in the Gulf, and all fully supported our position. Most, though, wouldn't say much publicly. Nobody wanted to get on Iran's wrong side. Given the escalatory talk on both sides, the White House decided to send Pompeo, the nation's top diplomat, out on the Sunday news shows to articulate our policy toward Iran, de-escalate tensions, and open room for negotiations. This was not what he conveyed, however. That same Sunday, January 5th, on board Air Force One, Trump doubled down on his threats toward Iran by telling reporters, "They're allowed to kill our people, they're allowed to torture and maim our people, they're allowed to use roadside bombs and blow up our people, and we're not allowed to touch their cultural sites? It doesn't work that way." The president's vow to strike Iranian cultural sites provoked its own little firestorm, prompting me to disagree with him publicly. I don't know how or why the president latched onto this idea of striking Iranian cultural and historical sites. He usually crafted his Twitter messages and media statements with just one or two other people, or whoever else was in the room with him at the time. They were never coordinated outside of the Oval Office, it seemed, let alone with the departments. While I suspect Trump intended the Friday and Saturday messages to intimidate the Iranians, I thought they were antagonizing and unnecessary. Privately messaging the Iranians would have been more effective. When asked about this by CNN the next day, I said that the U.S. military will follow the laws of armed conflict, which prohibit attacking cultural, historic, and religious sites that have no military value. These were the most basic of things that I learned going all the way back to my law and ethics classes at West Point. The president's comments were frustrating because they were wrong and provocative, and they created unnecessary friction between him and his cabinet. They also moved the conversation off topic, as he so often did to his own detriment. I wasn't trying to rebuke the president, but I did need to make a clear and unequivocal statement to the U.S. military. They needed to hear from me that we would follow the law, our ethical obligations, and our duty as professionals. It was important for our allies and partners to hear as well. After all, we bore the responsibility of leadership in the free world. The president quickly reversed course on this issue the next day, but he was not happy about my remarks. I had pushed back on him many times in private, going all the way back to my first weeks on the job when I urged the release of security assistance funding to Ukraine, defended the value of NATO, and opposed arbitrarily withdrawing troops from Korea, for example. I had also made public statements in the past that he didn't like, but this direct rebuke really raised his hackles, friends close to the White House told me. Only a long time later, in retrospect, would I see January as the next phase in our declining relationship, as he realized I wasn't going to echo or support his every claim and statement. It wasn't long before domestic politics rushed onto the scene. The House would soon be submitting articles of impeachment to the Senate regarding the president's call with his Ukrainian counterpart. Reactions to the strike on Capitol Hill largely divided along party lines. We briefed the House and Senate separately in classified sessions. The biggest issues became the question of imminence, or how soon or quickly Soleimani's orchestrated attacks might have begun. The executive branch's lack of pre-consultation with Congress before conducting a military operation, and the legal authorities under which the president acted to employ military force. The last issue, regarding legality, went back to the authorities provided President George W. Bush in 2001 and 2003 as he prosecuted the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, respectively. Many in Congress came to believe that the legislative branch had given the executive too much authority, a blank check, to conduct military operations around the world. The Trump administration defended these authorities as necessary, as had the Obama and Bush administrations before us. However, pressure had grown in Congress to repeal them, and the strike on Soleimani simply renewed the fight between the two branches of government on this matter. Often not raised by the Congress, though, is the president's Article II constitutional authority as commander-in-chief, which was also available to him in this matter. Article 2 allows the president to act without prior approval from the legislative branch, as Ronald Reagan did in his 1986 airstrikes on Libya, George H.W. Bush did in his 1989 invasion of Panama, and Bill Clinton did in his 1998 missile strikes in retaliation against Al-Qaeda's attack on our embassies, to name a few. The issue of pre-consultation with Congress by the executive was another matter that went back far, far longer than the 2001 and 2003 authorities to use military force. One of its most notable moments in modern U.S. political history was the passage of the War Powers Act in 1973 over President Nixon's objections. Beginning in the mid-2000s, I taught a graduate course on the relationship between Congress and the executive branch when it came to national security, so I knew there would be no immediate resolution to this issue either. Pre-consultation with congressional leaders was a fine rule to follow, but it wasn't always practical, and you had to be conscious about operational security. I was not concerned with any specific lawmaker, but in the most sensitive matters, we typically restricted information to only those who really had to know. In such cases, I felt notification as soon as possible after the fact was important, and did so in the Soleimani strike. In the first hours after the attack, I called the leaders of Congress to inform them about what had happened. I was able to reach all of them except House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who was with the president and receiving a personal update from Trump. My conversations with Senate GOP Leader Mitch McConnell and Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer were straightforward and businesslike. They appreciated the call and my commitment to brief them in more detail. It was difficult to reach Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. She was at some type of event on the West Coast and kept pushing the call back. I eventually got her on the line later that evening. I generally had positive conversations with the Speaker in the past, but this turned into a 10 to 15 minute political rant. I listened patiently to her, interrupting at times to address a statement she made or to steer the call back on topic. Her focus was on Trump and his lack of character. She saw him as partisan and corrosive, and viewed the strike on Soleimani as illegal and dangerous. She was very concerned that his recklessness was going to get us into a war with Iran. I told her that we had a strong case for this action and wanted to brief her as soon as possible. It seemed as if she was talking to others on the line or in the room as some type of political theater, which caused me to be somewhat reticent. She wrapped up, turning slightly apologetic, saying, "I know you're not like the president, Mr. Secretary. I know you know what's right. We're counting on the Defense Department." I listened. She added, "I know you can't respond, but you need to know how my side and I feel." I thanked her for her candor and asked if there was anything else relevant to the operation that I might answer. In a tired and spent voice, she said, "No, thank you." "Thank you for your time, Madam Speaker," I responded, and with that, we ended the call. A few months before, in October 2019, when the United States launched the raid that killed Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, the president did not inform congressional leaders beforehand either. Some Democrats complained about the lack of pre-consultation then as well. When asked about this, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican, simply said, "I wasn't briefed, but I was in the similar position when President Obama ordered the attack on Osama bin Laden. I was not called in advance then, nor do I expect to be called in advance now. But they attempted to let me know before he went public. So the two situations were handled exactly the same from my point of view." Regarding imminence, this issue was the one that engendered a number of intense views and heated discussions. There was no clean time mark in law or practice that said this minute, those hours, these days, etc., was the demarcation point between something being imminent or not. It was based on several factors, and at the end of the day, it relied on the judgment of the person who had to decide. The attack Soleimani was orchestrating, I was briefed, could occur in a few short days, two or three, although one couldn't rule out it taking longer. For me, I kept going back to CIA Director Haspel's bottom line. The risk of doing nothing far outweighed the risk of doing something. I was convinced the threat was imminent, and so I felt we had a duty to act. Our allies affirmed the rightness of the president's decision. Pompeo and I began calling our partners in the region, as well as our NATO allies most involved in the Middle East, following the strike. Each one was supportive of the strike and understood the rationale. Their practical concerns focused on whether we were seeking war with Iran. "No," I told them, "just the opposite." And second, whether we were withdrawing from Iraq. Also, "No, we plan to continue supporting the Iraqis and ensure the continued defeat of ISIS," I said. Millie and I spoke with the press on January 6, 2020. The chairman got easily frustrated with the second-guessing and political sniping by members of Congress and outside experts. We all were. And so when asked about this matter, he made a very forceful and passionate statement. "I've seen words like, 'Oh, the intel was razor thin.' Very, very few people saw that intelligence. He, Secretary Esper, and I saw that intelligence. And I will be happy when the appropriate time comes in front of the proper committees and anybody else, through history and every... I'll stand by the intelligence I saw that was compelling. It was imminent. And it was very, very clear in scale, scope. Did it exactly say who, what, when, where? No. But he was planning, coordinating, and synchronizing significant combat operations against U.S. military forces in the region, and it was imminent. And I know there's a lot of debate out there about all those words, and I understand it, but I'm not going to go further than that because of the sources and methods. And I know people saying, well, you're hiding behind and you lie and all that. That's not true. I know what I saw. And I think I said publicly previously, and I will reiterate it, that we, those of us who were involved in the decision-making of that, we would have been culpably negligent to the American people had we not made the decision we made. Given Milley's role as the senior-most uniformed leader, his comments may have resonated the most. The question of imminence didn't really fade, though, until the Capitol Hill Gang of Eight, the chairman and ranking members of the two intelligence committees, plus the House and Senate leaders with whom the executive branch shares the most sensitive information, received access to the special intelligence that had been shared with us days before the strike. The Gang of Eight at the time were Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Richard Burr, Vice Chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Mark Warner, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff, and House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence Ranking Member Devin Nunes. There wasn't unanimity in their view of the information as we saw it after being briefed, based on the reports I received, but a majority of members came to understand our rationale. The issue seemed to fade after that. Much of what drove the questions about imminence was a lack of trust by Democrats and others that the president was being honest. I was sympathetic to this to an extent. The simple fact was that Trump usually exaggerated and often made statements that could not be confirmed. Others were outright fabrications. I became ensnared in one of these rhetorical webs on a Sunday morning talk show. On Friday, January 10th, Trump told Fox News that Soleimani planned to attack several diplomatic posts in the Middle East, remarking, "I can reveal that I believe it probably would have been four embassies." Not long before that, Pompeo had told the media the United States didn't know when or where the attacks might occur, but acknowledged that embassies were threatened. This was consistent with my understanding of the intelligence, the reports I was receiving, and precautionary actions we were taking. Embassy Baghdad was obviously under threat, and State had enough concerns about Embassy Beirut that we reinforced that side as well. In addition, as I mentioned earlier, the safety of our embassies in Kuwait and Bahrain concerned me. That said, I didn't recall any specific mention of four sites in my briefings and reports from the CIA. Therefore, when I appeared on CNN on Sunday, January 12th, I made two things clear. First, that I hadn't seen any specific evidence with regard to the targeting of four embassies. And second, that I still believed there were threats against multiple embassies, noting that we had reinforced other diplomatic posts. Regardless, my unwillingness to affirm Trump's specific claim that the intelligence said Soleimani targeted four embassies plunged me into hot water with the president. A trusted colleague told me that some of Trump's friends called to report on me, complaining that I was undermining him and not loyal, and even suggested he fire Esper for being honest. This wasn't the first time I found myself on the spot like this. Maybe I just wasn't savvy enough to answer my way around the question, but I also didn't want to come across as disingenuous. One other example stands out. On October 16, 2019, the president invited congressional leaders to the White House to discuss Turkey's invasion of Syria and Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops from the northern part of the country. The group met around 3:30 p.m. in the large, ornate cabinet room, a 1902 addition to the West Wing for the president to meet with his cabinet, members of Congress, and heads of state. The room overlooks the Rose Garden and is less than 30 feet from the Oval Office. Portraits of several presidents, my favorites being Washington and Lincoln, hung prominently on the walls. At the far end were white marble busts of famous statesmen such as Benjamin Franklin. These were great reminders of the exceptional men who led our country through truly difficult times. Unlike most of these events, where pre-meeting chit-chat sets the tone, followed by a formal opening and exchange of pleasantries, this one went bad immediately. Over 30 people filled the chairs around the long, oval mahogany table that was a gift from President Nixon in 1970. Members of Congress sat on one side in the heavy leather seats with staff behind them. The president and his team sat on the side closer to the windows, along with a few GOP leaders. Given the topic of the meeting, I was seated to the president's immediate left, with General Milley to his right. Trump kicked off the session with a recalcitrant opening, brusquely suggesting the Democrats go first since they asked for the meeting. Just prior to the session, the House overwhelmingly approved a resolution condemning the president's decision to pull U.S. troops out of northeastern Syria, so the stage was already set for a contentious meeting. Almost immediately, Trump and the Democratic leaders began barking back and forth at one another regarding Syria. The Democrats charged that Trump was jeopardizing our nation's security and abandoning our Syrian allies. They suggested the president withdrew from Syria as a favor for Russian President Vladimir Putin, who was working to consolidate his position in the Middle East. Trump pushed back forcefully, quickly returning fire and criticizing the Democrats' Russia witch hunt. The rest of us sat there like spectators watching boxers in a ring exchange blows. Milley kept his head down. This was a bad situation for a uniformed officer to be in. He seemed to be doing his best to become invisible. I looked up a couple of times at the large gold-framed painting at the north end of the room, above a white fireplace. It was a picture of our founding fathers at a meeting of the Continental Congress. I briefly wondered if they ever had a meeting like this one. Things only got worse. With impeachment proceedings in the House lurking as the 800-pound gorilla in the room, the exchange between the president and the Speaker of the House, who was sitting right across from him, became particularly nasty. Insults flew between them, with Trump calling Nancy Pelosi just a politician, Pelosi responding with, "I wish you were one." Ever wanting the last word, the president doubled down with a schoolyard-style taunt, calling the speaker a third-rate politician. Minority Leader Schumer cut in once, trying to calm things down, but another exchange erupted over who hated ISIS more. At another point, Schumer dragged former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, my predecessor, into the exchange by citing the retired general's concern over a resurgent ISIS. Trump responded by dismissing Mattis's view and calling him, as he so often did, the world's most overrated general. As words were flying back and forth between Trump, Pelosi, and Schumer, everyone else continued to look on uncomfortably. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer was seated to Pelosi's immediate left. He leaned over and, in a level but disgusted tone, urged her to leave, slightly nudging his chair askew as he did. Pelosi quickly stood, pushed back her chair, and leaned forward slightly in her sharp blue dress. Waving her hands like a symphony conductor and then pointing directly at Trump, she chastised the president in one final flourish. "With you, Mr. President," she pronounced, "all roads lead to Putin." Trump was now red in the face, shouting back and talking over Pelosi as he leaned onto the table. She pivoted about quickly, and as she stormed out of the cabinet room with Hoyer right behind her, Trump tauntingly said, "Goodbye, we'll see you at the polls." This was the most unprofessional and uncomfortable exchange I had ever witnessed. It demonstrated a poisonous and dysfunctional relationship that wasn't good for anybody, especially the nation. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, picked up the questioning as the cabinet room door closed. With Pelosi's chair to his left, now empty, Schumer leaned over the table, arms folded in front of him, peering over his glasses, and asked the president question after question about Turkey's actions in Syria and our response. Trump responded as quickly as Schumer served, two New Yorkers going head-to-head. Despite the tension remaining high, both men managed to keep the volume down. Schumer then asked about the status of thousands of ISIS prisoners held by the SDF, Syrian Democratic Forces, and how many had escaped. Trump claimed that few had been freed and most of those had been recaptured, which wasn't accurate based on what I had read the previous day. Schumer pushed back, asking how he knew that. As a member of the Gang of Eight, he had access to this level of information, so he probably knew the president wasn't correct. Trump paused for a moment, maybe realizing the same thing, and said something like, "I had special intelligence, that's how I know." For some reason, Schumer turned immediately to me. I was sitting next to the president, looked me in the eyes from across the table and asked, "Secretary Esper, did you see that intelligence?" The minority leader and I had known each other for some time, so maybe he knew I wasn't going to go along with Trump's story. Regardless, he caught me like a deer in the headlights. I, too, paused, thinking about the question, trying to recall my latest intelligence update, and said as matter-of-factly, honestly, and succinctly as possible, trying to navigate this minefield, "I haven't seen that intelligence, but I don't always keep up with it the way I should," or something like that. I was sure my response made the president mad. It had to. I didn't support his story. Yet he never turned toward me or said anything. He just sat there, stone cold, focused on Schumer. I simply had never seen nor heard the intelligence to which Trump was referring. Long after midnight in Baghdad on January 8, 2020, Iran launched 16 ballistic missiles at two Iraqi bases in retaliation for Soleimani's killing. 11 hit the Al-Assad airbase. One struck a base in Erbil but didn't detonate, and 4 never reached their targets. The first missiles, which were fired from 3 launch sites in Iran, landed at 1:34 a.m. Iraqi time at Al-Assad, 5:34 p.m. Washington time. From first launch until the last explosion, at least one more volley would follow over an 80-minute period. I was meeting with my senior leaders, both military and civilian, in my inner conference room when the missile defense warning call activated over the secure phone in my office. One of my assistants rushed down the hallway and interrupted the meeting to get me. Colorado is the home base for America's missile warning system. In the days following the strike on Soleimani, the threat warning crews at Buckley Air Force Base and Cheyenne Mountain were on high alert. The Space Force's 2nd Space Warning Squadron at Buckley, which operated the 6-satellite space-based infrared system that night, would provide the critical early warning for our service members in Iraq to seek cover. The squadron had developed a collection plan to ensure optimal coverage, and once the infrared flares of the Iranian missiles appeared on their screens, they could determine the threat class of the missile. This was critical information when trying to assess the missile's range and payload capability. The automated missile warning system to which they provided the critical information had been in place for years. The squadron constantly rehearsed the system. Now it was sending real warning information through my secure phone. The squadron quickly counted the number of missiles launched, determined the weapon type, and then estimated their likely impact points. Ballistic missiles are predictable as they follow their programmed trajectory, and these warnings gave our folks on the ground critical time to move into shelters, button up, and take other measures to protect themselves. Mackenzie had prudently taken several actions over the preceding days, and in the final hours before the launch, according to a 60 Minutes news story produced more than a year following the attack, after the Iranians took their last download of commercial overhead imagery of Al-Assad for targeting purposes, CENTCOM finished moving dozens of aircraft and hundreds of people off the base to protect them. It was a brilliant move. With no threat history of Iranian missile launches targeting Iraqi facilities or Americans in-country, Central Command heretofore had not seen the need for anti-ballistic missile systems in Iraq. Indeed, the last time a country attacked American forces with ballistic missiles like this was the 1991 Gulf War. There were still operations and people at Al-Assad that we needed to protect, however, concerned that a ground assault by Iranian-backed militias might immediately follow the missile strikes. With the first launches announced, I shook my head, frowned, and said to myself, "Okay, here we go." I was very concerned about what might happen in the next 10 to 15 minutes, especially about the fate of our people on the ground, but powerless to do anything to alter the immediate course of events. It would all come down to our brave soldiers and airmen in the impact zone at the airbase. At that moment, I remembered my time during the Gulf War. In the third week of January 1991, the 101st Airborne was repositioning itself farther north and west in Saudi Arabia. We moved under the cover of the ongoing air campaign into what's called an attack position. From there, our role in Operation Desert Storm was to helicopter deep into southern Iraq and cut off the main highway that the Iraqis would likely be using to either reinforce their troops in Kuwait or get them out as U.S. forces approached from the south. Either way, our mission was to block the highway and prevent any movement. This Hail Mary play, as some called it, would become one of the deepest air assaults in military history at the time and the farthest behind enemy lines, and its aim was to close the Iraqis' back door. While waiting one evening on the airfield to load the C-130 transporters that would fly us to our positions, the air raid sirens went off. We knew this meant a missile launch from Iraq. Since we were most concerned about chemical weapons, we quickly put on our protective masks, checked to ensure they were airtight, and then watched as one, then two bright lights moved quickly across the night sky to our south. We had nowhere to run or seek cover, so we hunkered down next to our rucksacks and weapons. Soon enough, Patriot missile systems launched in response, and we stared at them anxiously as the interceptors raced toward their targets, arcing upward to destroy Saddam's incoming Scuds. The Patriots destroyed the first missile, then the second one, in bright flashes and delayed booms. This lethal fireworks show would be our big excitement for the night, and a memory I'll never forget. However, at this moment, 29 years later, I could only imagine the fear of our soldiers and airmen at their posts on the lonely Iraqi airbase, bracing for what we first believed was a 27-missile salvo, each with a 1,000-pound warhead screaming in on top of them. I quietly asked God to watch over them. It wasn't until 6:40 p.m. or so D.C. time when the last Iranian missiles hit. Of course, we didn't know then if the campaign was over, only that for now, the last salvo launched from Iran had finally impacted. We were already on the phones with CENTCOM trying to get a casualty and damage assessment, but understood it would take time. I knew the outcome of this report would determine whether we were at war with Iran or not. General Milley and I went to the White House around 7:30 p.m. It was now dark as we rode over to join Vice President Pence, Secretary of State Pompeo, National Security Advisor O'Brien, and a handful of senior staff. We pulled into the driveway right next to the awning that extends over and protects the West Wing entrance, got out of the car, and quickly entered the building. It was much quieter and less busy than I expected, with few staff bustling around inside or hustling back and forth as they usually do between the White House and the old executive office building, which was no more than a couple of hundred feet across the narrow drive where the cars parked. Milley and I entered the room and sat in our usual places to the immediate left of the president's high-backed leather chair at the front of the Situation Room. Pence and Pompeo sat in chairs opposite us, with O'Brien down near the middle. We all stood briefly as Trump entered, and then sat back down as he did. The president was in a good mood, though he was more reticent than usual. Everyone carried a serious look on their face. Many had the slight, darkened eye bags that marked the fatigue of a long week. There wasn't much small talk this evening. We were at a significant decision point and a major moment in history. The president leaned forward in his chair, with his arms folded in front of him, resting comfortably on the table, and said, "Good evening, everyone. It's been a long day. So what do we know?" I can't recall whether the CIA provided an intelligence update first, but I summarized that we know Iran launched 16 ballistic missiles at two Iraqi bases. 11 hit the Al-Asad airbase, where our people are located. The remaining 5 were aimed elsewhere and were duds. General Milley chirped in after me, offering details on the types of missiles we believe they fired, the size of the warheads, and his sense of the amount of damage they can cause. Milley had a good sense of humor and was known for his occasional wisecracks and sarcasm, even with the president. But tonight, he was dead serious as he explained the damage a 1,000-pound warhead could deliver. Everyone listened closely, quietly. I added, "We don't yet know if the Iranians are done. They could fire more missiles, so everyone remains hunkered down at their bases." Chairman Milley and I told the room, "We have nothing confirmed either way when it came to the number of American casualties, and that it will take the better part of the evening to get a solid assessment." Trump listened carefully, taking it all in, constantly scanning the room as he so often did. There was little bravado. O'Brien suggested we implement one of our response options against Iran now. Milley and I pushed back, arguing as we so often did that we own the shot clock. Let's act smartly, not quickly. We need to first understand what happened, and second, what they intended, I said. Pompeo agreed. Moreover, Mike anticipated that Tehran might reach out to us through Switzerland's embassy in Tehran, a trustworthy conduit used by the United States to communicate with Iran since the 1979 revolution. Tehran didn't want to go to war with us, but they also had to respond. What would that be, and what would be their real message, if any? Understanding both the intent of the Iranian attack and the damage inflicted would help us determine the best course of action in response, I said. We needed to assess first, did they aim to kill or aim to warn? The Iranians had done the latter in the past by intentionally shooting missiles far off target, claiming victory in their media, and then standing down. Millie and I kept pressing everyone for patience until we got a solid report on our killed or wounded. It was still dark in Iraq. The troops remained dispersed around the base and hunkered down. It would also take the benefit of daylight to get a good assessment. Everyone seemed okay with that, though we were all still anxious to learn what happened. We agreed to reconvene back in the Situation Room at 7:30 the next morning. After our meeting that evening, Trump tweeted, "All is well," and said that damage assessments were ongoing, adding that he would make a statement on the attack the following morning. I thought it was important for the president to make a statement that evening, but giving the American people such a positive first report was not appropriate. We didn't know nearly enough about what was happening on the ground in Iraq, and the president knew that too. Given the size and nature of the attack, as General Milley explained, we could have had dozens of Americans killed or wounded. Trump walked himself out on a limb, but he would never be the one to take the fall. Milley worked the phones all night with McKenzie. Meanwhile, I stayed in touch with him and the White House. Before midnight on January 7th in Washington, the initial report was no casualties. That seemed hard to believe, and the old military adage that first reports are always wrong bounced around in Milley's and my heads. We both agreed that CENTCOM needed to check again. The second response came sometime after midnight. Again, no killed or wounded. Millie and I spoke one more time and ordered one final check. This time I was really specific. I wanted everything counted. We had reported no casualties on the al-Baghdadi raid and then learned that one or two of our special operators incurred minor injuries, not from enemy action though. This had been enough to create a stir with some in the media. This report had to be 100% accurate. Millie completely agreed and was all over it. The sun was up in Iraq, so that would be our best and final count. I went back to sleep for a couple of hours. When I woke up in the morning, we were still at zero casualties reported. Incredible. Millie felt that this was a solid number. McKenzie had worked it all night. This would be the number I reported to the president at the 7:30 a.m. meeting. At the White House meeting, everybody was pleased to hear the news when I told Trump no casualties. You could see faces relax and smiles emerge. A couple of thumbs ups cropped up, too, around the room. It was a good moment, though an unexpected one. The president congratulated me and General Milley, saying, "Great job, great job." Milley was quick to point out that it was really the CENTCOM team, all the way down to the soldiers and airmen on the ground, being very prudent and aggressive in their active defense, force protection measures, and taking care of one another. Trump asked to pass along his thanks to General McKenzie and his team. Milley reported that the Iranian missiles caused damage at the base to tentage, a building, a helicopter, and so on. In his view, these were not warning shots. They wanted to kill Americans. I agreed with that assessment. While I was not surprised on one hand, I was on the other. Did Iran really want to risk all-out war with the United States over the killing of Soleimani, a man who had his fair share of enemies and detractors in Tehran? The government in Tehran falsely reported that the Islamic Republican Guard Corps, IRGC, launched tens of missiles. Iranian news reports said the missile strikes killed 80 Americans. They were obviously playing to their domestic audience. Indeed, Ayatollah Khamenei would later boast that Iran has the power to give such a slap to a world power shows the hand of God. In the Situation Room that morning, though, the question was, do we respond to the ballistic missile attacks, or stand down. At this point, our reporting said the Iranian missile strike caused no American casualties. Our airstrike on December 29th, conversely, had killed 25 militiamen and wounded over twice that number, and Soleimani was off the battlefield for good. On the diplomatic front, the State Department was exchanging messages with the Iranian government through our Swiss intermediaries. We had urged Tehran not to escalate after our strike at the Baghdad airport. Iran responded nonetheless. They were now conveying that the evening's ballistic missile salvos were their last action, even without determining the impact of their strike. There would be no further attacks from them. They wanted things to end. At this point, with the score in our favor and our resolve demonstrated, we didn't see a compelling need to strike back. Nobody wanted another war in the Middle East, especially Trump. Therefore, the president decided that we were done too. Everyone supported this. Gina Haspel's assessment turned out to be accurate. Iran didn't want a war either. Importantly, no Americans would be killed in the orchestrated attack that Soleimani was prevented from launching. Moreover, we would soon observe Tehran exercising far greater effort to rein in the Shia militia groups in Iraq. Later that morning, the president appeared before the media, flanked by Pence, Pompeo, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, O'Brien, and me to update the American people. In his remarks, he noted that Iran was standing down. However, he took a hard line on their nuclear aspirations, recounting the events of the past couple of weeks, criticizing the Iran nuclear deal, and addressing a number of related issues. At the end, he spoke directly to the leadership in Tehran and the Iranian people, extending an olive branch as he suggested both countries embrace peace and a new way forward. His remarks sought to close this latest chapter in U.S.-Iranian relations. About a week later, we started getting reports out of CENTCOM that U.S. service members at Al-Assad the night of the attack had been medically evacuated to a military hospital in Germany. This surprised us. The base was supposedly screening everyone for traumatic brain injury, TBI. But symptoms could take days to appear, and the review process itself took a while. The military rightly took a conservative approach to these issues. We had learned a great deal about TBI given the many terrible years of experience gained in Iraq treating service members injured by roadside bombs and other explosions. Apparently, the troops sent to Germany from Iraq were experiencing daily headaches and other symptoms associated with a concussion, and our military facilities in Europe were better equipped to accurately diagnose and treat them. By late February, the official count of injured troops numbered 110, though mild TBI was the diagnosis for a majority of these cases, and the service members returned to duty. Nonetheless, the command eventually awarded the Purple Heart to nearly 30 military personnel given the extent of their injuries. The troubling part of this episode was the accusations coming from administration critics and suggestions from the media that Trump was lying about the number wounded when he announced no casualties to the press on January 8th. That was not true. The president was accurately conveying the report I personally delivered to him, the same one the chain of command relayed to me a few times the evening before. We also weren't aware of the first TBI cases evacuating to Germany before they actually happened. No one at the Pentagon was trying to downplay the injuries or underreport them. We simply didn't know what was unfolding on the ground until a week or so later. I wanted to understand as much as everyone else did why the injuries weren't reported to the Pentagon sooner. This was a matter we would dig into and fix over the succeeding months. I was disappointed and troubled by the president's careless comment later in January, though, when he downplayed the casualty reports as headaches that were not very serious. A majority did eventually fall into this category, but not all. It wasn't clear if this was part of his braggadocio, that he hit Iran hard and they didn't lay a glove on us in return. If so, the truth interrupted that narrative. I needed to go to the White House, explain to the president the nature of these injuries, and ask him to change his tone. So after a meeting in the Oval Office, I cornered him near the passageway that led to his private room in the back. I told the president that his comments aren't playing well with the force and that it sounds like you don't care. He pushed back with, "That's not true." I told him I understood, After all, I had witnessed him in private moments with injured soldiers and their families, and watched him spend time with them, talk with them, and take pictures. But that's not what's coming across. Trump got defensive, pivoting, speaking about the injured troops he met with in the past. The service members he spent time with at Walter Reed were some of the most seriously combat wounded, with limbs missing, badly mangled bodies, and horrible burns. They constituted his mental framework when it came to war injuries. I had met many of these brave warriors too, and understood where he was coming from. But the president didn't get it. He said, "What about the soldiers in World War II? They didn't have these brain injuries, they didn't complain about headaches." Without saying it explicitly, he was claiming these were fictional injuries. He couldn't reconcile the past with what we knew today. I told him TBI is not new to the battlefield. It's been around as long as large blasts, blunt force trauma, and other head injuries have occurred, I explained. Medical science, battlefield medicine, and a shortened timeline from injury to hospital arrival had given us the ability to save more people from the horrible and relentless improvised explosive device, IED, attacks against our forces in Iraq. Most of these service members would have died in the past, from the violent blasts, and the trauma and massive losses of blood that ensued, I told him. Moreover, unlike burns, lacerations, broken bones, and other visible wounds, it could take time for TBI symptoms to manifest themselves fully, and for the doctors to determine the extent of the injuries. New technologies also gave us the means to look inside the brain and learn a lot more about the heretofore hidden damage IEDs caused. The blasts from the Iranian missiles striking the base at Al-Asad were no different, I said. TBI was an invisible injury that many of us were still learning about, including me, I added. He stood opposite me, listening, but not hearing. He shook his head, either disagreeing or unwilling to accept my explanation. Regardless, the president, as commander-in-chief, should have demonstrated more empathy for our wounded warriors. Empathy wasn't his strong suit, however. Weeks later, I went to visit the wounded at Walter Reed Hospital, as I tried to do every 3 months or so. I met a young officer there who was being treated for TBI, resulting from injuries he received at Al-Asad the evening of the ballistic missile attacks. He was one of the more serious cases, but was thankfully doing much better. We sat down to talk at one of the tables in a large cafeteria-style dining area. My wife Leah joined us. He described in detail how, as he ran toward a bunker after checking on his soldiers, the blast from an exploding missile knocked him off his feet and threw him some distance. It took him a while in the dark of the night, amid all the chaos, to regain his senses, he said. But once he did and stood back up, he made his way into the concrete bunker where others were seeking shelter. Another missile exploded outside a short time later, he added, and the shockwave rippled through the shelter, bouncing off the walls and jostling everyone about. As he recounted, he had now been hit twice. Medical test results would later reveal the harm done. I asked why it took so long to report these cases. God bless him, he said. Sir, I had soldiers to take care of the next day, and every day after that. Sure, I had headaches and didn't feel right, but if I got evacuated, who would take care of my troops? His sense of duty choked me up. He said it took a few days until one of his fellow officers, or NCOs, coupled with his worsening symptoms, persuaded him to report to the medical staff. One thing quickly led to another, and sure enough, he was soon on a flight to Germany, and eventually back to Walter Reed. I would like to say this officer's story was unique, but in many ways it wasn't. It showed the leadership, commitment, and sense of duty our service members were exhibiting during a very challenging and dangerous time. You can't fault a leader for putting his or her people and mission first. That's what we teach them to do. He had his priorities right. However, at some point, the leader needs to take care of himself or herself or everyone else and the mission suffer. This was why he finally sought help, and what helps explain the delays in reporting. By the end of January 2020, as things settled down with Iran, we had the opportunity to consider changes to our force posture in the region. This was something we had begun before the recent events as part of our combatant command reviews. The DoD's footprint in Iraq was above 5,000 service members, and we had been planning to go lower, down to at least 3,000 by the summer. Doing so gave us the opportunity to consolidate all our forces onto a few larger bases that we could then harden to enhance force protection. Moreover, now that Iran had demonstrated a willingness to shoot ballistic missiles into Iraq, we needed Patriot and other air defense systems at these bases, especially against unmanned drones. General McKenzie's dispersal plans had been extremely effective. Without them, he estimated we would have lost between 100 to 150 personnel and 20 to 30 aircraft. He did a great job, but we now had to do more to protect our people as we looked ahead. The Iraqis kept denying us permission to bring the Patriots in, however. Eventually, we decided that force protection trumped diplomatic niceties and bureaucratic gamesmanship, so I directed him to unilaterally deploy and emplace them. We also took some major long-term lessons away from our experience in early January that built upon work that had already begun. One of them was the realization that too many of our bases and too many of our people in all the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, as well as in Iraq, were within range of too many Iranian missiles. For several months, I had laid out on my conference table a large map of the Arabian Peninsula with the location of each and every U.S. base and facility in the region. From that perspective, the vulnerability of our troops and families was obvious. Therefore, by the summer of 2020, we initiated several plans and discussions on how to reshape better our footprint for the long haul. The first initiative involved ending the practice of sending most family members with their service members to countries along the Gulf. The risk was too great, and we realized it was difficult to get them out of harm's way in times of crisis. We didn't want to put the families at risk, nor create a liability that limited our freedom of action. This decision was toughest for the Navy, which had the most family members in the region. This issue was acute at the 5th Fleet headquarters in Bahrain. Despite the clear missile threat, coupled with an enduring terrorism concern on the ground, too many senior leaders at the base were convinced that the Iranians would never attack us. The Bahrainis were great hosts and very good partners, but we still couldn't afford to ignore the facts. It would take 2 to 3 years to draw down our family members' presence there, but it was the responsible thing to do. Ending accompanied assignments scratched the surface of what we needed to do strategically for the 5th Fleet. When you stepped back, looked at the map, and considered the short distance to Iran, the time it took for a ship to get from Bahrain into the open waters of the Arabian Sea to the south, especially through the constricted and often contested Strait of Hormuz, and the growing Chinese activity in the Indian Ocean, the headquarters and our forces were out of place for the threats, challenges, and missions we faced in the future. We now seemed trapped in an operational cul-de-sac at the metaphorical end of the street with a bad neighbor next door. The Iranians had developed a vast array of missile capabilities that could overwhelm most defensive systems, leaving U.S. bases vulnerable. We were also subject to the continuous threat of Iranian proxies on the ground in some countries. Locating the headquarters and our forces inside the Persian Gulf, or at least near Iran, makes much less sense today, especially given the growing importance of the Indian Ocean. It was important that we maintain a presence in the Gulf to contain Iran and support our friends in the region. We wanted to remain the security partner of choice, as compared to the Russians or Chinese, for the Gulf Cooperation Council states and Iraq. However, to do this most effectively going forward, we needed the protection, confidence, and flexibility that distance provides to our bases, people, and forces. Therefore, the second major initiative we started working on was a plan to consolidate and move many of our bases and facilities in the frontline states farther west and south, away from Iran. The airfield at Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia was a first step, but even that base was still too close. This would be a multi-year effort developed by CENTCOM in coordination with our regional partners, and involved changing our basing and operational protocols so fewer forces were exposed on a daily basis. We would also look to harden established sites and develop deception measures to increase force protection. This was a major reason many of us felt the Iran nuclear deal should address Tehran's missile programs. Third, we also needed to return forces back home. especially headquarters and operational centers that could function equally well from the United States. CENTCOM operated out of Tampa, Florida, and proved the value and effectiveness of this model over the years. I also didn't see the need to maintain more than 60,000 American service members in the Middle East. We needed many of them elsewhere. By the fall, we had finalized plans to start reducing our footprint in the region, a long-sought goal of mine that was critical to implementing the National Defense Strategy. Patriot batteries were set to return to the United States from Saudi Arabia in 2021, followed by other Army assets, a Marine task force, Air Force aircraft, and more. We would further reduce our footprint in Iraq below 3,000 to include downgrading the three-star headquarters in-country. I also determined that a permanent stationing of an aircraft carrier in the Middle East was not necessary given all the other ground-based aircraft we had in the region. The same was true for other naval assets in constant demand by CENTCOM. We would use dynamic force employment operations from our IRF and other Navy assets to surge when necessary. Our plans cut the U.S. force presence in theater nearly in half, from its peak in January 2020 to the low 40,000s by the summer of 2021. The savings would allow us to invest in several of our modernization priorities, while reducing the churn on the services and their people. Regarding Fifth Fleet, I asked CENTCOM to look at locations around the rim of the Indian Ocean, out of the range of most Iranian missiles, in order to relocate the headquarters, support infrastructure, and the ships. General Milley and I also made a run at extricating the United States from the multinational force and observers mission in the Sinai, Egypt, but we ran out of time. We had a few hundred soldiers there helping other countries supervise the implementation of the security provisions of the Egyptian-Israeli Treaty of Peace, signed in 1979. This mission had outlived its usefulness after four decades, at least for the United States, given the much improved state of relations between Egypt and Israel. My combatant command reviews were revealing missions like this and others, such as the Kosovo Force International Peacekeepers in the Balkans, which were important when begun in 1999, but could now be performed without the United States. It seems the only thing harder than getting out of a war is getting your forces out of a peacekeeping mission whose raison d'etre has passed. We needed to focus on China and Russia, and at least give our troops a break. Finally, a major war with Iran would ultimately require the collaboration of all U.S. allies and partners in the region who saw Tehran as a threat. The successful prosecution of a campaign to defend against Iranian attacks and then go on the offensive with equal success would require a high degree of command, control, and coordination. As such, we would need much better unity of command and unity of effort, two long-standing principles of war and something the region certainly didn't have enough of, to ensure a positive outcome should war come. This is why I launched the process of changing the Unified Command Plan, UCP, to move Israel from the European Command, UCOM, into Central Command, where it belonged. The UCP, which the DoD updates every 2 years, sets forth basic guidance to all combatant commanders. The plan establishes combatant command missions, responsibilities, and force structure, delineates geographic areas of responsibility for geographic combatant commanders, and specifies functional responsibilities for functional combatant commanders. Past objections to moving Israel into CENTCOM centered on the politics of asking Arab military leaders to work with their Israeli counterparts in CENTCOM forums, but the growing and common threat of Iran, coupled with the easing of tensions between some Arab capitals and Tel Aviv over time, and then the rapid advancement of the Abraham Accords, which jump-started the process of normalizing relations between Israel and countries such as the United Arab Emirates, made this operationally prudent move possible. There was a fleeting, final concern from some in the Pentagon that making the move now was out of cycle for UCP modifications, but bureaucratic timelines shouldn't postpone good ideas, especially those involving the conduct of war. And so a UCP change that we first raised in early 2020, coordinated with the State Department over many months, discussed with Israel in the fall, and that I quickly approved soon thereafter, finally became a reality by the end of the administration. It was one of the quicker actions we were able to get done. Things calmed regarding Iran after January 2020, at least for a while. The country never left our radar screens, however. Occasional rocket attacks from militia groups against our bases or embassy in Iraq, tough talk from the government in Baghdad about reducing the American presence in the country, and infrequent comments by senior Iranian leaders about the United States kept us on our toes. It created an opportunity just the same to keep reshaping the theater consistent with the NDS and my overarching focus on China, then Russia, as well as my reform agenda that would enable it. The situation did not calm down in Washington, though. Things only got worse, more unpredictable, more uncoordinated, more outlandish. As processes began breaking down, hardcore loyalists arrived in the West Wing, and the darker, uglier side of some in the White House became more and more obvious. Chapter 7. The Politics of Building a Better Navy. The aircraft carrier nearly filled the entire periscope lens. The waterline, wave tops and all, were apparent about halfway up the photo, visible both near and far in the circular view. The object of its fixation was completely unaware it was being stalked. It was a snapshot straight out of a Hollywood World War II movie, with the submarine's periscope focused on a far-off ship, watching carefully, quietly, from beneath the sea. The difference was that this picture was only a few months old, and the vessel at the other end of the American periscope wasn't a Nazi battleship. It was a Chinese aircraft carrier. Without a doubt, the U.S. Navy is the most capable maritime force in the world. It has served our nation extremely well for almost 250 years. The purpose of the sea service is to guarantee America's security and safeguard our interests in the maritime domain, which includes ensuring freedom of navigation and commerce. These principles underlie America's security, economy, and the international rules-based order that has proven so successful. China wants to rewrite these rules to their advantage. Beijing seeks to control critical waterways and expand its claims over fishing areas and undersea oil fields. It wants to exert veto power over the economic and security decisions of other nations in ways that challenge their sovereignty. To do this, China is modernizing and growing its armed forces. When Beijing talks about fielding a world-class military by 2049, the purpose is to displace the United States as the global superpower and push us out of the Pacific. Beijing has studied how we fight, as has Moscow, and is developing a full range of capabilities designed to counter our strengths and maximize their own. For example, China is investing in long-range missiles, hypersonic weapons, and unmanned submarines as cost-effective counters to American naval power, intending to use these systems to destroy our aircraft carriers at great distances. China's nefarious behavior would only grow worse should Beijing achieve its modernization goals and build a military better than ours. We cannot let that happen. Hence, while the U.S. military fights as a joint force, retaining overmatch in the Indo-Pacific begins with the Navy. In the context of our national defense strategy, the Pentagon's overarching plan to transform the DoD to deal with the threats of the 21st century, the challenges we face in the future are clear enough. We know the capabilities the Chinese are building. Moreover, we have a good sense of their strategy, operational plans, and timeline. Given all the facts, data, and trends, the United States is behind when it comes to building a joint force that can fight and win by the mid-2030s. Transforming the military to deal with Beijing, however, faces its own unique headwinds and politics within the Navy and the DoD, on Capitol Hill, at the White House, and in D.C. and beyond. The shipbuilding plans of the Navy have been an interest of Congress since the earliest days of the Republic. Ostensibly, to understand the Navy's direction better, Congress requires the submission of a 30-year shipbuilding plan each year with the proposed defense budget. The law assigns the defense secretary this task, but often the Navy submits it on behalf of the DoD, and in some years, the Pentagon delivers it late, if ever. Not all defense secretaries reviewed the Navy's plans. I took a different approach. If the Pentagon is submitting a plan of this importance to Congress, one that charts the structure of the future Navy, then I want it to be knowledgeable about and confident in its content. After all, I owned it at that point. Moreover, the reports I was getting about the Navy's plans didn't assure me. As such, I decided that my OSD team, the Joint Staff, and I needed to get involved, so I put a hold on the Navy's submission. Despite a few lawmakers' specious claims that my delay would affect their ability to craft the next year's defense bill,